he said. It's like a dog gone to the bad. Once a sheep is killed, the dog will get a taste for it and must kill another. Have you been traveling very much? I said, as I did not like this talk of killing. Yes, he said, I am always on the move. I was lately down in the States where I can buy notions cheap and sell them up here for more. For that is how we peddlers earn our bread. We must be paid for our shoe leather. And what is it like there? I said. Some say it is better. In many ways it is the same as here, he said. There are rogues and scoundrels everywhere, but they use a different sort of language to excuse themselves, and there they pay a great lip service to democracy, just as here they rant on about the right order of society and loyalty to the Queen. Though the poor man is poor on every shore. But when you cross over the border, it is like passing through air. You wouldn't know you'd done it, as the trees on both sides of it are the same. And it's generally through the trees I go, and by night, as paying the custom duties on my goods would be an inconvenience to me, and also the price to such good customers as you would have to go up, he said, with a smile. But are you not breaking the law? Said I. And what would become of you if caught? Laws are made to be broken, he said. And these laws were not made by me or mine, but by the powers that be, and for their own profit. But I am harming no one. A man with any spirit in him likes a challenge, and to outwit others. And as to being caught, I'm an old fox, and have been at it a few too many years for that. Also, I am a lucky man, as can be read inside my hand. And he showed me a cross on the palm of his right hand, and one on the left as well, both of them in the shape of an X. And he said he was protected both asleep and awake, as the left hand was the hand of dreams. And I looked into my own hands, but could not see any such crosses. Luck can run out, I said. I hope you will be careful. Why, Grace, do you have a tender concern for my safety? Said he with a smile, and I looked down at the table. Indeed, he said more seriously, I have thought about giving up this line of work, as there is now more competition than formerly, and with the improvement of the roads, many go into the towns to make their purchases instead of staying at home and buying from me. I was disappointed to hear he might stop the peddling, as it meant he would not be coming any more with his pack. But what would you do then? I said. I could go about the fairs, he said, and be a fire-eater, or else a medical clairvoyant, and trade in mesmerism and magnetism, which is always a draw. As a younger man, I was in partnership with a woman who knew the business, as the thing is generally worked in couples. I was the one who made the passes and also took in the money, and she was the one to have a muslin veil put over her and go into a trance and speak in a hollow voice and tell the people what was wrong with them, for a fee, of course. It is well nigh foolproof, for as they can't see inside their own bodies, who's to say whether you are right or not? But the woman got tired of it, or else of me, and went off down the Mississippi on one of the boats. Or I could become a preacher, he continued. Below the border there's a great demand for it, more so than here, in particular during the summers, when the preaching is done outdoors or in tents, and the people there love to fall down in fits or talk in tongues and be saved once a summer, or more if available, for which they are willing to show their gratitude by a liberal scattering of coinage. That's a promising line of work, and rightly carried on, it pays a good deal more than this. I did not know you were religious, I said. Nor am I, said he. But so far as I can tell, it is not required. Many of the preachers there have no more faith in God than a stone. I said it was wicked of him to say so, but he only laughed. So long as the people get what they come for, what does it matter? He said. I would give full measure. A faithless preacher with a good manner and voice will always convert more than a limp-handed, long-faced fool, no matter how godly. Then he struck a solemn pose and intoned, Those strong in the faith know that in the Lord's hands even the infirm vessel is put to right use. I see you have made a study of it already, I said, for he did sound exactly like a preacher, and he laughed again. and then he looked more earnest and leant across the table. "I think you should come away with me, Grace," he said. "I don't like the feel of things." "Come away," I said. "What do you mean?" "You would be safer with me than you are here," he said. At that I gave a shiver, for it was close to what I myself had been feeling, although I did not know it until then. "But what could I do?" I said. "You could travel with me," he said. "You could be a medical clairvoyant. I would teach you how, and instruct you in what to say, and put you into the trances. I know by your hand that you have a talent for it, and with your hair down you would have the right look. I promise you'd earn more that way in 2 days than you do scrubbing the floors here in 2 months. You would need a different name, of course. A French one, or something foreign, because the people on this side of the ocean would find it hard to believe that a woman with the plain name of Grace had mysterious powers. The unknown is always more wonderful to them than the known, and more convincing." I said, "Wouldn't that be a deception and a cheat?" And Jeremiah said, "No more than at the theater. For if people wish to believe a thing and long for it and depend on it to be true and feel the better for it, is it cheating to help them to their own belief by such an insubstantial thing as a name? Is it not rather a charity and a human kindness?" And when he put the thing that way, it had a better light on it. I said that a new name would pose no problem for me, as I had no great attachment to my own, it having been my father's, and he smiled and said, "Let us shake hands on it, then." I won't conceal from you, sir, that the idea was greatly tempting, for Jeremiah was a handsome man with his white teeth and dark eyes, and I recalled that I was supposed to marry a man with a J to his name, and I thought also of the money I might have, and the clothes I could buy with it, and perhaps some gold earrings as well. And I would also see many other places and towns, and not always be doing the same hard and dirty chores. But then I remembered what had happened to Mary Whitney. And although Jeremiah seemed kindly, appearances can be deceptive, as she found to her cost. What if things went wrong, and I was left in the lurch by myself in a strange place? "Would we be married, then?" I said. "What would be the need of that?" he said. "Marriage never did any good, as far as I can see. For if the two are of a mind to keep together, they will. And if not, then one of them will run off, and that's the long and short of it." This alarmed me. "I think I had better stay here," I said. "In any case, I'm too young to be married." "Consider it, Grace," he said, "for I wish you well, and am willing to help you and care for you. And I tell you truly that you are surrounded by dangers here." At this moment McDermott entered the room, and I wondered if he had been listening outside the door and for how long, for he seemed very angry. He asked Jeremiah who the devil he might be and what the devil he was doing in the kitchen. I said that Jeremiah was a peddler, and well known to me from former days, and McDermott looked in the pack, which was open by this time, for Jeremiah had opened it up as we were talking, although he had not spread out all of the things, and said that was all very well, but Mr. Kinnear would be annoyed to find out that I had been wasting good beer and cheese on a common rogue of a peddler. He said this not because he cared two straws about what Mr. Kinnear might think, but only to insult Jeremiah. And I replied that Mr. Kinnear was generous-minded, and would not refuse an honest man a cold drink on a hot day. And at that McDermott scowled even more, for he did not like it if I praised Mr. Kinnear. Then Jeremiah, to get between and make the peace, said that he had some shirts, which although used were good ones, and a bargain, and they were just the size to fit McDermott. And although McDermott grumbled, Jeremiah brought them out and displayed their qualities. And I knew McDermott was in need of some new shirts, having torn one of his past mending, and ruined another by letting it lie muddied and damp, so that the mildew got into it. And I saw that his attention was caught, and silently brought a mug of beer for him. The shirts were marked H.C., and Jeremiah said they'd belonged to a soldier, a gallant fighter too, but not a dead one, for it was bad luck to wear the clothes of the dead, and he named a price for all four. McDermott said he could only manage three at that price, and named a lower. And so they went on until Jeremiah said, well, he would do it. He would give the four for the price of three, but not a penny less, though it was highway robbery, and he would be bankrupt in no time if things went on this way. And McDermott was very pleased with himself to think he'd made such a tight bargain. But I could see by the twinkle in Jeremiah's eye that he was only pretending to let McDermott get the better of him, and in fact had come out of it very well. Now, sir, these were the very same shirts that figured so largely at the trial, and there was much confusion over them, firstly because McDermott said he'd got them from a peddler, then changed his tune and said from a soldier. But in a sense both were true, and I believe he turned the story that way because he did not want Jeremiah standing in court against him, knowing he was a friend of mine, and would help me, and would testify against McDermott's character, or so he must have thought. And secondly, because the newspapers could not get the number of shirts right. But there were four of them, not three, as they said. For two were in McDermott's carpet bag, and one was found covered with blood behind the kitchen door, which was the one McDermott had on when he was disposing of Mr. Kinnear's body. And the fourth was on Mr. Kinnear himself, because James McDermott put it there. So that makes four, not three. I walked with Jeremiah partway down the drive, with McDermott looking on with a baleful scowl from the kitchen doorway, but I didn't care what he thought, as he was not my owner. When the time came to part, Jeremiah looked very earnestly at me and said he would come back soon for my answer, and he hoped for my sake, as well as his own, that it would be yes. And I thanked him for his good wishes. Just knowing I could go away if I wanted to made me feel safer, and happier as well. When I went back into the house, McDermott said it was a good riddance, and he didn't like the man, as he had a low, foreign look about him, and he supposed he'd come sniffing around after me like a dog after a bitch in heat. I did not reply to this remark, as I found it very coarse, and was surprised by the violence of his expression. And I asked him to kindly remove himself from the kitchen, as it was now time for me to busy myself with the supper. It was only then that I remembered the peas that I dropped in the garden and went outside to pick them up. Several days later, the doctor paid us a visit. Dr. Reed was his name, an elderly gentleman, or so he appeared. But with doctors it is hard to tell, as they put on grave faces and carry many sorts of illnesses about with them, in their leather satchels where they keep the knives, and this makes them old before their time. And as with crows, when you see two or three of them gathered together, you know there is a death in the offing, and they are discussing it. With the crows, they are deciding which parts they will tear open and make off with. And so it is with the doctors. I do not mean you, sir, as you have no leather bag or knives. When I saw the doctor coming up the drive in his one-horse gig, I felt my heart beat painfully, and I thought I was about to faint. But I did not do so, as I was downstairs by myself and would have to answer for anything that might be needed. Nancy would be no help. She was upstairs, lying down. On the day before, I'd assisted her in fitting the new dress she was making, and so I'd spent an hour kneeling on the floor with my mouth full of pins while she turned around and viewed herself in front of the mirror. She remarked that she was getting too plump, and I said it was a good thing to have a bit of flesh, as it did not do to be all skin and bones, and that the young ladies nowadays were starving themselves because of the fashion, which was to be pale and sickly, and they laced their stays in so tight they fainted as soon as looked at. Mary Whitney used to say that no man wanted a skeleton, they liked something to take hold of, some at the front and some at the back, and the more arse the better. But I did not repeat this to Nancy. The dress she was making was a light cream-colored American print with sprigs and buds, and a tucked bodice coming to a point below the waist, and three layers of flounced ruffles to the skirt, and I told her it was very becoming. Nancy frowned at herself in the mirror, and said all the same her waist was getting too big, and if it kept on she would need a new pair of stays, and soon she would be a great fat fishwife. I bit my tongue, and did not say that if she would keep her thumbs out of the butter she'd stand less chance of it. Half a loaf of bread she'd gobbled before breakfast, and spread with butter thick as tar, and plum jam on top of it. And the day before I'd seen her eating a slice of pure fat trimmed off the ham in the pantry. She'd asked me to lace her stays just a little tighter, and then fit the waist again. But as I was doing so, she said she felt unwell. It was no wonder, considering what she'd been eating, though I'd set it down as well to the tightness of the lacing. But this morning she'd also had a spell of dizziness, or so she said, and this after hardly any breakfast and no tight lacing at all. So I was beginning to wonder what was the matter, and thought that perhaps the doctor had been summoned for Nancy. When I saw the doctor coming, I was outside in the yard, pumping another pail of water for the wash, for it was a fine morning, and the air hard and clear, and bright, hot sunlight, and a good drying day. Mr. Kinnear went out to greet the doctor, who tied up his horse to the fence, and then they both went into the house by the front door. I went on with what I was doing and soon had the wash hanging up on the line, which was a whitewash consisting of shirts and nightdresses and petticoats and the like, but no bedsheets. And all the while I was wondering what business the doctor had with Mr. Kinnear. The two of them had gone into Mr. Kinnear's little office and shut the door, and after a moment's consideration I went quietly into the adjoining library to dust the books, but I was unable to hear anything from inside the office except a murmuring of voices. I was imagining all sorts of things, such as Mr. Kinnear coughing up blood and gasping his last, and I was working myself up into a state over him. So when I heard the office door handle turning, I went quickly along through the dining room into the front parlor with my duster and cloth, as it is always best to know the worst. Mr. Kinnear showed Dr. Reed to the front entrance, and the doctor said that he was sure they would have the pleasure of Mr. Kinnear's company for many years to come, and that Mr. Kinnear had been reading too many medical journals which gave him ideas and caused him to imagine things, and that there was nothing wrong with him that a healthy diet and regular hours would not cure, but for the sake of his liver he should limit his drink. This speech relieved me. Yet I reflected that it was a thing a doctor may say to a man who is dying to spare him the worry. I looked cautiously out of the parlor through the side window. Dr. Reed went over to his horse and gig, and the next thing I knew, there was Nancy, with her shawl clutched around her and her hair half down, in conversation with him. She must have crept down the stairs without my hearing her, which meant she didn't wish Mr. Kinnear to hear her either. I thought she might be trying to find out what was wrong with Mr. Kinnear, if anything, but then it came to me that she could also be consulting him about her own sudden illness. Dr. Reed drove off, and Nancy turned toward the back of the house. I heard Mr. Kinnear calling for her from the library, but as she was still outside and might not want it known what she'd been doing, I went into him myself. Mr. Kinnear did not look any the worse than usual and was reading a copy of The Lancet from the large pile of them he kept on a shelf. Then, all at once, it came over me what was the matter with her. I'd seen it often enough before. The eating of strange foods at odd times, the sickness and the green tinge around the mouth, the way she was plumping out like a raisin in hot water, and her quirkiness and irritation. She was in a delicate condition. She was in the family way. She was in trouble. I stood there gaping at her, as if I'd been kicked in the stomach. Oh, no. Oh, no, I thought. I felt my heart going hard like a hammer. It cannot be. That evening Mr. Kinnear was at home, and he and Nancy took their supper in the dining room, and I carried it in. I scanned his face, looking for a consciousness there of Nancy's condition, but he did not know. What would he do when he found out? I wondered. Boot her into the ditch? Marry her? I had no idea and could not rest easy with either of these futures. I wished Nancy no harm and did not want her cast out, a waif on the common highway and a prey to wandering scoundrels, but all the same it would not be fair and just that she should end up a respectable married lady with a ring on her finger, and rich into the bargain. It would not be right at all. Mary Whitney had done the same as her and had gone to her death. Why should the one be rewarded and the other punished for the same sin? I cleared the things off the table as usual after they had gone into the parlor. By this time it was hot as an oven, with gray clouds blotting out the light, although it was not yet sunset, and still as the grave, with no wind, but heat lightning flickering on the horizon, and a faint growling of thunder. When the weather is like that, you can hear your own heartbeat. It is like hiding and waiting for someone to come and find you, and you don't know who that person will be. I lit a candle so I could see to eat my own supper, which I took with McDermott. Cold roast beef it was, as I couldn't bear to cook anything hot for us. We ate it in the winter kitchen, and with it we had beer and some of the bread, which was still fresh enough and very nice, with a slice or two of cheese. Then I washed up the supper things and dried them and put them away. McDermott was cleaning the shoes. He'd been sullen during our supper and said why couldn't we have proper cooked food like the steaks with new peas the others had eaten, and I said new peas did not grow on trees, and he ought to know who would have the first choice of them, as there had been only enough for two, and that in any case I was Mr. Kinnear's servant, not his, and he said that if I was his I would not last long, as I was such a foul-tempered witch, and the only cure for me was the end of a belt, and I said ill words butter no parsnips. I could hear the sound of Nancy's voice from the parlor, and I knew she must be reading out loud. She liked to do it, as she thought it was genteel, but she always pretended that Mr. Kinnear required it of her. They had the parlor window open, even though the moths would get in that way, and that is why I could hear her. I lit another candle and told McDermott I was going to bed, to which he said nothing but only gave a grunt, and he took up his own candle and went out. When he was gone, I opened the door to the passageway and looked along it. The light from the globe lamp was falling through the half-open parlor door, making a light patch on the passage floor, and Nancy's voice was coming out into the hall as well. I went quietly along the passageway, leaving my candle on the kitchen table, and stood leaning against the wall. I wanted to hear the story she was reading. It was The Lady of the Lake, which Mary Whitney and I had once read together, and it made me sad to recall it. Nancy read it well enough, though slowly, and sometimes stumbling over a word. The poor madwoman had just been shot by mistake and was expiring while speaking several lines of verse, and I thought it a very melancholy part. But Mr. Kinnear did not agree, for he said it was a wonder anyone could move an inch in romantic landscapes such as those of Scotland without being accosted by mad women who were always jumping in front of arrows and bullets not intended for them, which had the virtue at least of putting an end to their caterwauling and misery, or else they were constantly throwing themselves into the ocean, at such a rate that the sea soon would be so clogged with their drowned bodies as to constitute a serious hazard to shipping. Then Nancy said he lacked a proper feeling, and Mr. Kinnear said no, he did not, but it was well known that Sir Walter Scott had put so many corpses into his books for the sake of the ladies, because the ladies must have blood. There is nothing that delights them so much as a weltering corpse. Nancy told him gaily to be quiet and behave himself, or she would have to punish him and stop reading. She would play the piano instead. And Mr. Kinnear laughed and said he could endure any form of torture but that. There was a sound of a little slap and a rustling of cloth, and I decided she must be sitting on his knee. For a time there was quiet, until Mr. Kinnear asked Nancy if the cat had got her tongue, and why was she so pensive. I leant forward, as I thought she must be about to inform him of her condition, and then I would know which way things were going to fall. But she did not. Instead, she told him that she was worried about the servants. Which of the servants, Mr. Kinnear wanted to know, and Nancy said both of them. And Mr. Kinnear laughed and said of course there were three servants in the house, not two, as she was a servant herself. And Nancy said it was kind of him to remind her of that, and she must now leave him, as she had her duties in the kitchen to attend to. And there was another sound of rustling and of struggling, too, as if she was trying to get up. Mr. Kinnear laughed some more and said she should stay where she was. It was her master's command. And Nancy said bitterly that she supposed that was what she was paid for. And then he soothed her and asked her what was worrying her about the servants. Was the work getting done was the main thing, he said. And he did not much care who cleaned his boots as long as they were clean, as he paid good wages and expected to get value for his money. Yes, Nancy said, the work was getting done, but in the case of McDermott only because she stood over him with a whip. And when she scolded him for being lazy, he was insolent with her, and and she had given him his notice. Mr. Kinnear said he was a surly, black-browed rascal, and he'd never liked him. And then he said, "What about Grace?" And I strained my ears the better to hear what Nancy said. She said that I was tidy and quick about my work, but that I had lately become very quarrelsome, and she was thinking of giving me my notice. And when I heard that, my face went hot all over. Then she said there was something about me that made her quite uneasy, and she wondered whether I was quite right, as she'd several times heard me talking out loud to myself. Mr. Kinnear laughed and said that was nothing. He often talked to himself, as he was the best conversationalist he knew. And I was certainly a handsome girl, as I had a naturally refined air and a very pure Grecian profile, and that if he put me in the right clothes and told me to hold my head high and keep my mouth shut, he could pass me off for a lady any day. Nancy said she certainly hoped he would never say such flattering things to me, as it would turn my head, and give me ideas above my station, which would be no favor to me. Then, she said, he had never had such agreeable opinions of her, and he said something I couldn't hear, and there was more silence and rustling. And then Mr. Kinnear said that it was time for bed. So I made my way quickly back to the kitchen and sat down at the table, for it would not have done for Nancy to catch me listening. But I did listen afterwards, once they'd gone up. And I heard Mr. Kinnear saying, "I know you're hiding. Come out right now, you dirty girl. Do as I say, or I will have to catch you. And when I do..." And then a laugh from Nancy, and then a little scream. The thunder was coming closer. I've never liked a thunderstorm, and did not then. When I went to bed, I secured my shutters so none of the thunder could get in, and pulled the covers up over my head, although it was so hot, and I thought I would never get to sleep. But I did, and was awakened in the pitch darkness by a tremendous crashing as if the end of the world had come. A violent storm was raging, with a sound of drums and roaring, and I was beside myself with terror, and cowered in my bed, praying for it to be over, shutting my eyes against the flashes of light that came in through the cracks in the shutters. The rain was pouring down like 10,000, and the house working in the wind like grinding teeth, and I was sure that every next minute we would be split in two like a ship at sea and sink down into the earth. And then, right next to my ear, I heard a voice whispering, "It cannot be." I must have been frightened into a fit, because after that I lost consciousness altogether. Then I had a very strange dream. I dreamt that all was quiet again, and that I got out of my bed in my nightdress, and unlatched my chamber door, and walked across the floor of the winter kitchen in my bare feet and out into the courtyard. The clouds had been swept away and the moon was shining brightly, and the leaves of the trees looked like feathers of silver. And the air was cooler, with a touch to it like velvet. And there were crickets chirping. I could smell the wet garden smell, and the sharp tang of the henhouse. And I could also hear Charlie whinnying softly from the stable, which meant he knew there was someone close by. I stood there in the yard beside the pump with the moonlight falling over me like water, and it was as if I could not move. Then two arms stole around me from the back and began caressing me. They were a man's arms, and I could feel the mouth of this same man on my neck and cheek, kissing me ardently, and his body pressed up against my back, but it was like a game of blind man's buff that children play, as I could not tell who it was, nor could I turn and look. I caught the scent of road dust and leather, and thought it might be Jeremiah the peddler. Then it changed to a smell of horse dung, so I thought it was McDermott. But I could not rouse myself to push him away. Then it changed again, and was the odor of tobacco and of Mr. Kinnear's fine shaving soap, and I was not surprised, as I had been half expecting something of the sort from him. And all the while the mouth of the unknown man was on my neck, and I could feel his breath stirring my hair. and then I felt it was not any of these three, but another man, someone I knew well and had long been familiar with, even as long ago as my childhood, but had since forgotten. Nor was this the first time I'd found myself in this situation with him. I felt a warmth and a drowsy languor stealing over me, and urging me to yield and surrender myself, as to do so would be far easier than to resist. But then I heard the neighing of a horse, and it came to me that this was not Charlie, nor the colt in the barn, but a different horse altogether. A great fear came over me, and my body went entirely cold, and I stood as if paralyzed with fear, for I knew that the horse was no earthly horse, but the pale horse that will be sent at the day of reckoning, and the rider of it is Death, and it was Death himself who stood behind me, with his arms wrapped around me as tight as iron bands, and his lipless mouth kissing my neck as if in love. But as well as the horror, I also felt a strange longing. At this, the sun came up, not little by little, as it does when we are awake, sir, but all at once, with a great blare of light. If it had been a sound, it would have been the blowing of many trumpets, and the arms that were holding me melted away. I was dazzled by the brightness, but as I looked up, I saw that in the trees by the house and also in the trees of the orchard, there were a number of birds perching, enormous birds, as white as ice. This was an ominous and baleful sight, as they appeared crouched as if ready to spring and destroy, and in that way they were like a gathering of crows, only white. But as my sight cleared, I saw that they were not birds at all. They had a human form, and they were the angels, whose white robes were washed in blood, as it says at the end of the Bible, and they were sitting in silent judgment upon Mr. Kinnear's house, and on all within it. And then I saw that they had no heads. In the dream I then lost consciousness from sheer terror, and when I came to myself I was in my own bed, in my small chamber, with the quilt drawn up to my ears. But after I rose, for it was already dawn, I found that the hem of my nightdress was wet, and my feet had the marks of earth and grass on them, and I thought I must have been walking around outside without knowing I was doing so, as had happened to me once before on the day that Mary Whitney died, and my heart sank within me. I proceeded to dress as usual, vowing to keep my dream to myself, because who was there I could trust with it in that house? If I told it as a warning, I would only be laughed at. But when I went outside to pump the first pail of water, there was all the laundry I had done the day before, blown into the trees by the tempest during the night. I'd forgotten to bring it in. It was very unlike me to forget a thing like that, especially a white laundry, which I'd worked so hard at getting out the spots. And this was another cause of foreboding to me. And the nightdresses and the shirts which were stuck in the trees did indeed look like angels without heads. And it was as if our own clothing was sitting in judgment upon us. I could not shake the feeling that there was a doom on the house, and that some within were fated to die. If I'd been given the chance right then, I would have taken the risk and gone off with Jeremiah the peddler. And indeed, I wanted to run after him, and better for me if I had, but I didn't know where he had gone. Dr. Jordan is writing eagerly, as if his hand can scarcely keep up, and I have never seen him so animated before. It does my heart good to feel I can bring a little pleasure into a fellow being's life, and I think to myself, I wonder what he will make of all that. 9. Hearts and Gizzards. During the evening, James Walsh came in and brought his flute with him. Nancy said we might as well have some fun, as Mr. Kinnear was away. Nancy said to McDermott, "You have often bragged about your dancing. Come, let us have a dance." He was very sulky all the evening and said he would not dance. About 10 o'clock we went to bed. I slept with Nancy that night. Before we went to bed, McDermott said to me that he was determined to kill her that night with the axe when in bed. I entreated him not to do so that night, as he might hit me instead of her. He said, "Damn her. I'll kill her then, first thing in the morning." I got up early on the Saturday morning, and when I went into the kitchen, McDermott was cleaning the shoes. The fire was lighted. He asked me where was Nancy. I said she was dressing, and I said, "Are you going to kill her this morning?" He said he would. I said, "McDermott, for God's sake, don't kill her in the room. You'll make the floor all bloody." "Well," says he, "I'll not do it there, but I'll knock her down with the axe the moment she comes out." Confession of Grace Marks, Star and Transcript, Toronto, November 1843. That cellar presented a dreadful spectacle. Nancy Montgomery was not dead, as I had thought. The blow had only stunned her. She had partially recovered her senses and was kneeling on one knee as we descended the ladder with the light. I don't know if she saw us, for she must have been blinded with the blood that was flowing down her face, but she certainly heard us and raised her clasped hands as if to implore mercy. I turned to Grace. The expression of her livid face was even more dreadful than that of the unfortunate woman. She uttered no cry, but she put her hand to her head and said, "God has damned me for this." "Then you have nothing more to fear," says I. "Give me that handkerchief off your neck." She gave it without a word. I threw myself upon the body of the housekeeper, and planting my knee on her breast, I tied the handkerchief around her throat in a single tie, giving Grace one end to hold, while I drew the other tight enough to finish my terrible work. Her eyes literally started from her head. She gave one groan, and all was over. I then cut the body in four pieces and turned a large washtub over them. James McDermott, to Kenneth Mackenzie, as retold by Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. The death, then, of a beautiful woman is, unquestionably, the most poetical topic in the world. Edgar Allan Poe, The Philosophy of Composition, 1846. The heat of summer has come without warning. One day it was still cold spring, with gusting showers and chilly white clouds remote above the glacial blue of the lake. Then, suddenly, the daffodils withered. The tulips burst open and turned inside out as if yawning, then dropped their petals. Cesspool vapors rise from backyards and gutters, and a mist of mosquitoes condenses around every pedestrian's head. At noon, the air shimmers like the space above a heated griddle, and the lake glares, its margins stinking faintly of dead fish and frog spawn. At night, Simon's lamp is besieged by moths, which flutter around him, the soft touch of their wings like the brushing of silken lips. He is dazed by the change. Living through the more gradual seasons of Europe, he'd forgotten these brutal transitions. His clothing is heavy as fur. His skin seems always damp. He's under the impression that he smells like bacon fat and soured milk, or perhaps it's his bedchamber that smells this way. It hasn't been thoroughly cleaned for far too long, nor the sheets changed. No suitable maid-of-all-work has yet been located, though Mrs. Humphrey details her efforts along these lines to him every morning. According to her, the departed Dora has been spreading stories around the town, among all the potential serving girls at least, about how Mrs. Humphrey has not paid her and is about to be turned out bag and baggage on account of having no money, and also about how the major has run off, which is even more disgraceful. "So, of course," she tells Simon, "it stands to reason that no servants wish to take their chances in such a household." And she smiles a rueful smile. She herself has been cooking the breakfasts, which they continue to share at her table, her suggestion, to which he's agreed, as it would be humiliating for her to have to carry a tray up. Today Simon listens to her with fretful inattention, toying with his humid toast and with his egg that he now takes fried. At least with a fried egg, there are no surprises. Breakfast is all she can manage. She is subject to fits of nervous prostration and headache, brought on by the reaction to shock, or so he assumes, and has told her, and by afternoon is invariably stretched out on her bed with a wet cloth pressed to her forehead, giving off a strong smell of camphor. He can't let her starve herself to death, so although for the most part he eats his meals at the wretched inn, from time to time he attempts to feed her. Yesterday he bought a chicken from a rancorous crone in the market, but not until he got it home did he discover that although it had been plucked, it had not been cleaned. He could not face the task. He'd never cleaned a chicken before in his life. And thought of disposing of the avian corpse. A walk by the lakeshore, a swift fling of the arm. But then he recalled that it was only a dissection, after all, and he'd dissected worse than chickens. And once he had his scalpel in hand, he's kept the tools of his former trade with him in their leather satchel, he was all right again, and managed a neat incision. After that, things got worse, but he'd come through it all right by holding his breath. He cooked the chicken by cutting it into pieces and frying it. Mrs. Humphrey came to the table saying she felt a little better, and ate a good deal of it for one so fragile. But when the washing had to be done, she suffered a relapse, and Simon was left to do it himself. The kitchen is even greasier than it was when he first entered it. Dust rolls have gathered under the stove, spiders in the corners, breadcrumbs beside the sink. A family of beetles has moved into the pantry. It is alarming how quickly one descends into squalor. Something must be done soon, some slave or lackey acquired. In addition to the dirt, there is the question of appearances. He cannot continue to live alone in this house with his landlady, especially not such a tremulous landlady, and one deserted by her husband. If it becomes generally known and people begin to talk, no matter how groundless such talk would be, then his reputation and professional standing may suffer. Reverend Verringer has made it plain that the enemies of the reformers will use any means, however base, to discredit their opponents, and in case of a scandal he'd be given his discharge in short order. He could at least do something about the state of the house if he could summon the will for it. In a pinch he could sweep the floors and stairway and dust the furniture in his own rooms, but there would still be no hiding the odor of muted disaster, of slow and dispirited decay that breathes from the limp curtains and accumulates in the cushions and woodwork. The advent of the summer heat has made it worse. He remembers with nostalgia the clatter of Dora's dustpan. He's gained a new respect for the Doras of this world, but although he longs for such household problems to resolve themselves, he has no idea how this may be accomplished. Once or twice he's thought of asking Grace Marks for advice, how a maid should properly be hired, how a chicken should properly be cleaned. But he has thought better of it. He must retain his position of all-knowing authority in her eyes. Mrs. Humphrey is talking again. The subject is her gratitude to him, as it often is while he is eating his toast. She waits until his mouth is full, then launches in. His gaze wanders over her, the pale oval of her face, her stringent and bloodless hair, her crackling black silk waist, her abrupt white edgings of lace. Underneath her stiff dress there must be breasts, not starched and corset-shaped, but made of soft flesh, with nipples. He finds himself idly guessing what color these nipples would be, in sunlight or else in lamplight, and how large. Nipples pink and small, like the snouts of animals, of rabbits or mice, perhaps, or the almost red of ripening currants, or the scaly brown of acorn caps. His imagination runs, he notes, to wildwood details, and to things hard or alert. In reality, this woman does not attract him. Such images arrive unsummoned. His eyes feel squeezed, not a headache yet, but a dull pressure. He wonders if he's running a low fever. This morning he examined his tongue in the mirror for telltale blanching and spots. A bad tongue looks like cooked veal, grayish-white, with a scum on it. The life he's leading is not healthy. His mother is right, he should marry. Marry or burn, as St. Paul says, or search out the usual remedies. There are houses of ill repute in Kingston as everywhere, but he cannot avail himself of them as he might in London or Paris. The town is too small, and he is too conspicuous, his position too precarious, the governor's wife too pious, the enemies of reform too ubiquitous. It's not worth the risk. And in any case, the houses here are bound to be depressing. Sadly pretentious, with a provincial idea of the alluring in their wistfully upholstered furnishings. Too much brocade and fringe, but also briskly utilitarian, run on the North American mill-town factory principle of quick processing, and dedicated to the greatest happiness of the greatest number, no matter how grim and minimal the quality of that happiness may be. Soiled petticoats, whores sunless flesh pallid as uncooked pastry and smudged by the thick tarry fingers of sailors, and by those, more manicured, of the occasional government legislator traveling through, sheepishly incognito. It's just as well he must avoid these places. Such experiences drain the mental energies. "Are you ill, Dr. Jordan?" asks Mrs. Humphrey as she hands him a second cup of tea, which she has poured for him without being asked. Her eyes are motionless, green, marine, the pupils small and black. He wakes with a start. Has he been asleep? "You were pressing your hand to your forehead," she says. "Do you have a pain there?" She has a habit of materializing outside his door while he's trying to work, asking if there is anything he needs. She is solicitous of him, tender almost, yet there is something cringing about her, as if she's waiting for a slap, a kick, a flat-handed blow, which she knows with dreary fatalism will surely come sooner or later. But not from him. Not from him, he protests silently. He is a mild-tempered man. He has never been given to outbursts, to rampages and violence. There is no news of the major. He thinks of her naked feet, shell-thin, exposed and vulnerable, tied together with, where has this come from? An ordinary piece of twine, like a parcel. If his sub-threshold consciousness must indulge in such exotic poses, it ought to be able to supply at least a silver chain. He drinks the tea. It tastes of marshes, the roots of bulrushes, tangled and obscure. He's had some intestinal problems lately and has been dosing himself with laudanum. Fortunately, he has a good supply. He suspects the water in this house. Perhaps his intermittent digging in the yard has disturbed the well. His plan of a kitchen garden has come to nothing, though he's turned over a satisfying amount of mud. After his days spent wrestling with shadows, he finds it a curious relief to get his hands into something real, such as earth. But it's getting too hot for that. "I must go," he says, and stands up, pushing back his chair, wiping his mouth brusquely, making a show of bustle, although in fact he has no appointment until the afternoon. Useless to stay in his room to try to work. At his desk he will only doze, but with his ears alert, like a drowsing cat's attuned to the sound of footsteps on the stairs. He goes out, wanders at random. His body feels insubstantial as a bladder emptied of will. He is carried along beside the lake shore. He squints into the immense morning light, passing here and there the solitary fishermen as they cast their lures into the tepid and indolent waves. Once he's with Grace, things are a little better, as he can still delude himself by flourishing his own sense of purpose. Grace at least represents to him some goal or accomplishment. But today, listening to her low, candid voice, like the voice of a childhood nurse reciting a well-loved story, he almost goes to sleep. Only the sound of his own pencil hitting the floor pulls him awake. For a moment he thinks he's gone deaf, or suffered a small stroke. He can see her lips moving, but he can't interpret any of the words. This, however, is only a trick of consciousness, for he can remember, once he sets his mind to it, everything she's been saying. On the table between them lies a small and dispirited white turnip. which both of them have so far ignored. He must concentrate his intellectual forces. He can't afford to flag now, give in to lethargy, lose hold of the thread he's been following over the course of these past weeks, for at last they are approaching together the center of Grace's narrative. They are nearing the blank mystery, the area of erasure. They are entering the forest of amnesia, where things have lost their names. In other words, they are retracing, day by day, hour by hour, the events which immediately preceded the murders. Anything she says now may be a clue, any gesture, any twitch. She knows, she knows. She may not know that she knows, but buried deep within her, the knowledge is there. The trouble is that the more she remembers, the more she relates, the more difficulty he himself is having. He can't seem to keep track of the pieces. It's as if she's drawing his energy out of him, using his own mental forces to materialize the figures in her story, as the mediums are said to do during their trances. This is nonsense, of course. He must refuse to indulge such brain-sick fancies. But still, there was something about a man in the night. Has he missed it? One of those men, McDermott, Kinnear. In his notebook, he has penciled the word whisper and underlined it 3 times. Of what had he wished to remind himself? My dearest son, I am alarmed that I have not heard from you for so long. Are you perhaps unwell? Where there are mists and fogs, there are bound to be infections, and I understand that the situation of Kingston is quite low, with many nearby swamps. One cannot be too careful in a garrison town, as soldiers and sailors are promiscuous in their habits. I hope you will take the precaution of keeping indoors as much as possible during this intense heat and not going out in the sun. Mrs. Henry Cartwright has purchased one of the new domestic sewing machines for the use of her servants, and Miss Faith Cartwright was so intrigued by it that she has tried it herself and was able to hem a petticoat with it in very little time, which she most thoughtfully brought over yesterday so that I might see the stitching, as she knows I am interested in the modern inventions. The machine works tolerably well, though there is room for improvement. Snarls of thread occur more often than is desirable and must be cut or untangled. But such devices are never perfected at first, and Mrs. Cartwright says that her husband is of the opinion that the shares in the company which manufactures these machines would prove a most sound investment over time. He is a most affectionate and considerate father, and has given much study to the future welfare of his daughter, who is his only surviving child. But I will not bore you with talk of money, as I know you find it tedious, although, dear son, it does keep the larder supplied, and is the means for coming by those small comforts which make the difference between a threadbare existence and a life of modest ease. And as your dear father used to say, it is a substance which does not grow on trees. Time is not running at its usual unvarying pace. It makes odd lurches. Now, too quickly, it's evening. Simon sits at his desk, the notebook open before him, and stares stupidly out through the darkening square of window. The hot sunset has faded, leaving a purple smear. The air outside vibrates with insect whines and amphibious peepings. His entire body feels swollen like wood in rain. From the lawn comes a scent of withering lilacs, a singed smell, like sunburned skin. Tomorrow is Tuesday, the day when he must address the governor's wife's little salon, as promised. What can he possibly say? He must jot down a few notes, organize some sort of coherent presentation, but it's no use. He can't accomplish anything of importance, not tonight. He can't think. Moths beat against the lamp. He sets aside the question of the Tuesday meeting and turns instead to his unfinished letter. My dear mother, my health continues excellent. Thank you for sending the embroidered watch case made for you by Miss Cartwright. I am surprised you were willing to part with it, even though, as you say, it is too large for your own watch, and it is certainly exquisite. I expect to finish my work here quite soon. Lies and evasions on his side, and on hers, plottings and enticements. What does he care about Miss Faith Cartwright and her endless and infernal needlework? Every letter his mother sends him contains news of yet more knitting, stitching, and tedious crocheting. The Cartwright household must by this time be covered all over, every table, chair, lamp, and piano, with acres of tassel and fringe, a woolwork flower heavily abloom in every nook of it. Does his mother really believe that he can be charmed by such a vision of himself, married to Faith Cartwright and imprisoned in an armchair by the fire, frozen in a kind of paralyzed stupor, with his dear wife winding him up gradually in colored silk threads like a cocoon, or like a fly snarled in the web of a spider? He crumples the page, drops it onto the floor. He will write a different letter. My dear Edward, I trust you are in good health. I myself am still in Kingston, where I continue to... But continue to what? What exactly is he doing here? He can't sustain his usual jaunty tone. What can he write to Edward? What trophy or prize can he show? What clue, even? His hands are empty. He has discovered nothing. He has been traveling blindly, whether forward he cannot say, without learning anything, except he has not yet learned anything, unless he counts the extent of his own ignorance, like those who have searched fruitlessly for the source of the Nile. Like them, he must take into account the possibility of defeat. Hopeless dispatches, scrawled on pieces of bark sent out in cleft sticks from the swallowing jungle, suffering from malaria, bitten by snake, send more medicine. The maps are wrong. He has nothing positive to relate. In the morning he will feel better. He will collect himself, when it is cooler. For the moment, he goes to bed. In his ears, there's a simmering of insects. The damp heat settles down on his face like a hand, and his consciousness flares up for a moment. What is it he's on the verge of remembering? Then gutters out. Suddenly, he starts awake. There's a light in the room, a candle, floating in the doorway. Behind it, a glimmering figure. His landlady, in a white gown, with a pale shawl wrapped around her. In the candlelight, her long, loose hair looks gray. He pulls the sheet up over him. He is not wearing a nightshirt. "What is it?" he says. He must sound angry, but in fact he's frightened. Not of her, surely. But what the devil is she doing in his bedroom? In future, he must lock the door. "Dr. Jordan, I am so sorry to disturb you," she says. "But I heard a noise, as if of someone attempting to break in through a window. I was alarmed." There's no trembling in her voice, no quavering. The woman has a very cool nerve. He tells her he will come downstairs with her in a minute and check the locks and shutters. He asks her to wait in the front room. He fumbles into his dressing gown, which sticks immediately to his moist skin, and shuffles through the darkness towards the door. "This must stop," he tells himself. "This can't go on." But nothing has been going on, and therefore nothing can stop. It's the middle of the night, but time keeps going on, and it also goes round and around, like the sun and the moon on the tall clock in the parlor. Soon it will be daybreak. Soon the day will break. I can't stop it from breaking in the same way it always does, and then from lying there broken. Always the same day, which comes around again like clockwork. It begins with the day before, and then the day before, and then it's the day itself. A Saturday. The breaking day. the day the butcher comes. What should I tell Dr. Jordan about this day? Because now we are almost there. I can remember what I said when